It's time to change the situation if Tottenham wants to change.
It's in the past, it's in the past. Then we look forward, buy our football positive. We're wearing Tottenham shirts, we play the Tottenham way.
And still Ricky Villa! What a fantastic run! He scored!
That's going to have a crack. He is, you know.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of The Tottenham Way, where we're now living in a post-Ange Postecoglou era at Tottenham. Ange Postecoglou has been sacked as the manager of Tottenham Hotspur just 16 days since winning the first trophy for the club in 17 years with that unforgettable Europa League win in Bilbao. It seems pretty brutal. Whatever way you look at it, whether you think it's the right call or not, it's definitely feels a quite a brutal sacking, at least, of Ange. And I'm joined by Tom Allnutt. I'm, of course, Tom Barkley from The Sun. Tom Allnutt from The Times is with me, all the way from Barcelona, where he is for England this week. And we're going to get into it, really. So, Ange Postecoglou sacked on Friday afternoon after what felt like one of the longest weeks ever in terms of sort of radio silence from the club, where we were just sort of waiting. But I think we all got the sense that this is the way it was going to go. It was just a matter of when rather than if. But there was the sense that maybe Daniel Levy might have a change of heart from his original plan, whether they won the Europa League or not, to sack Ange. Maybe there could be some sort of possible emotional U-turn, but that proved not to be the case. And Ange is no more at Spurs. Tom, initial thoughts from what has been a pretty massive day in the world of Tottenham Hotspur.
Hi, Tom. I guess my predominant feeling is a sense of sadness. I don't know if that's sort of the right way to feel as a journalist, but I sort of I liked Ange. You know, I make no bones about that. Like, I liked him, I liked his personality, his character, I liked what he brought to the job and to press conferences, of course, for us. But I also just, I like the way he saw the game, you know, and I think we said before, I always felt his sense of this kind of agenda from the media and from us was always misplaced. And I always felt kind of slightly sorry about that because I honestly couldn't feel any different. You know, I always was massively rooting for the kind of Postecoglou story, someone who made the journey he made all the way to the Premier League to get there at this stage of his career. You know, and I didn't doubt the stuff that he said about people writing him off all along the way. And I think all of that was completely true and completely valid. And so I was, you know, personally, with a very professional hat on, of course, all the way, I was always rooting for Ange. You know, I was always wanting him to be a huge success at Spurs. I feel sad that we're not going to have him next season. I feel sad he won't be in the Premier League. I think the Premier League and Tottenham will be a sort of almost like a worse or less interesting place for him not being there. But I have to say, I think it's probably the right decision. I think it's the smart and sensible decision from Spurs. I completely understand that everyone has their opinions on this. And ultimately, I guess it comes down to feelings and where you kind of prioritise your feelings and whether you think, you know, whether he deserves to stay because of Bilbao and everything that happened and winning a trophy. I completely see that. I just have always felt that the weight of evidence over the last 18 months and even 2 years in relation to the results and the injuries, I think meant this was the, as you said, brutal decision, but I think it was the right one. What are your instant feelings? What's your deep down in your gut? How are you feeling this evening? We should say we're recording on Saturday night. So if anyone's been appointed on Sunday morning, that's why we're not mentioning it. Oh, you're on mute, Tom. You need to unmute yourself. We're not going to hear your feelings unless you press that button. There you go.
I was going to say, I think we are still on Friday night, as far as I'm aware.
Oh, sorry.
It does feel like this week has gone on forever. But similar, definite feeling of sadness, as much as that maybe isn't the right thing to be completely analytical. I liked him a lot. I always valued what he gave us in the media, but he was just he still is sort of speaking about him in the past tense. He's obviously not gone in that sense, but he's gone from Spurs. he was just like, it was just an old school romantic in so many ways. Almost a bit of a unicorn of a manager in the modern age anyway, who, you know, railed against a lot of things like VAR in his own way, and sort of harked back to a time where, yeah, there was a sort of romanticism to football compared to the never-ending, almost like business sort of heavy aspect of the game these days. And I always felt like whenever you went into a press conference with him, and I think I've said this a few times, compared to Conte, even though Conte was box office, it felt like with Conte, it didn't really matter what you asked him. He knew, he said what he was going to say, whatever. And you could throw anything at him on any subject. It didn't have to be football. And you get, and you consider what he thought, and he'd answer in a really, often in a really articulate, insightful way that you maybe you weren't even expecting, which from a journalist's perspective was absolute gold. I think he carried himself with a lot of integrity, despite, I know a lot of people sort of might point to the sort of spiky post-match interviews, but when I say integrity, I more mean how he dealt with what I believe was a pretty difficult situation for actually quite a long time at the club. I don't think it was like the final months. I think it might have been going on longer than that, where the relationship between him and Daniel Levy might not have been the best. And you know, even to the end, really, he'd never really called out the board, even though, or Levy in particular, even though I think there might have been an argument for him doing so, and others would have. I mean, yes, in those final couple of months, particularly post the international break in March, we sensed from the journalists who spoke to him pretty much every week, where you're analysing every single word he says, a slight difference in some of the tone and some of the content of his language, which was a bit more, wasn't even being critical of the ownership, but just a slight change, which kind of felt like, oh, something may have happened here. But it definitely wasn't anything like what we saw with Conte or others. And I think he deserves a lot of respect for that, particularly in the way that I believe he's been treated in the last couple of weeks since winning in Bilbao. I mean, if they wanted to sack him, which it looks like was probably what was always the plan, maybe it was just delayed a bit because of winning the actual trophy, they could have kept him more in the loop. I understand that he's not being kept in the loop for a long part of this period until it's finally happened on Friday. But you know, I also don't, I'm not a fan, so that is part of why I can kind of overlook to a certain extent some of how bad some of the performances have been or the results have been in the Premier League, which I understand for someone like Marcus is a real red line, and I get that. But I also see that argument. But I just fundamentally, coming back to one of the podcasts we did quite recently where we talked about, can you really make a decision on him over one more game, which he himself made the point. I was saying that it wasn't just one more game. It's the value of that match and getting over the line, given the context of Spurs' history and lack of silverware. I felt it was huge. And basically just it gave him the right, or should have given him the right, to try and correct all the wrongs of the league season this year, next season. And if it didn't work out, it didn't work out. And I guess all the data suggests, probably would have suggested, that it wouldn't have. And I'll come on to the statement in a second from Spurs, which clearly shows that they didn't think that was going to be the case. And so, yes, there's part of me that would think maybe there's evidence would suggest that wasn't going to change, which is kind of your argument. And I get that, but I almost feel like he earned the right to at least have a go.
Yeah, I just don't agree. I just can't see that, because I understand it emotionally. You know, like if I was Ange's mate, or if I was, you know, his dad or something, then yeah, I would be like, you deserve it, you know, like go for it. You know, I might not think it's going to work, but ultimately this is, you know, something you've earned. But that's not how a football club works or a big business works.
But a game's about winning. It's about winning. He won. Even if the league season was a disaster, he won, and no one else does. I mean, I still, and yes, you can say that Europa League was not what it was in years gone by with no Champions League teams in it, and they had a maybe favourable draw, whatever. He still won. And I just think the value of that is big. And also, the way in which he won was such a change from what happened before that I would argue it showed that he could adapt. Maybe it happened way too late. And if he had done it earlier, maybe he'd still be here. But that would be, it wouldn't, it's not just an emotional response, although admittedly there is a big part of it that does probably feel an emotional response, which is why they've left it probably as long as they have, to let the euphoria die down to a certain extent.
I mean, I agree. Look, he won, and the, you know, the prize for that is the trophy. The prize for that is Champions League qualification. Like that, the prize is not a blank sheet and a new contract to stay for as long as you want. You know that he gets what he's won, which is a fantastic, you know, achievement and all that's happened in the last few weeks. But you can't, if you think that Tottenham going forward are going to be a worse club or are going to be more at risk of having another season where they have to sack someone in the middle of the campaign, if you think on the balance of probabilities that is more likely, then you have to make the decision that goes against that. You have to make the decision that is the right thing for the club going forward, not the right thing for Ange Postecoglou. Like, we can all feel, you know, and I've started this podcast by saying, you know, I'm sad that he's gone, but, and we can all feel the sense that we would love Ange to have done well. But that's not how you can run the club. If you're Daniel Levy and you're the best paid director in the league, if you're Johan Lang and you've been brought in to make decisions on the basis of, you know, reams of data and statistics and long-term trends, you can't make the biggest decision you can make that will dictate the future of the club on the basis of, we feel like you deserve it just because you had one match where you won 1-0. I just don't think that's the right way to go about it. And I take your point about the pragmatism, but ultimately that comes down to the idea. You're basically saying, we believe that next season you would change your approach, your style of play. We believe you would change your methods and your attitude towards conditioning so that the injuries won't happen again. The confrontations, by the way, were also problematic for the club. So we believe you would change your personality in terms of how you deal with the press, how you deal with fans after defeats. This is a lot of change. And you come down, you come to the point eventually where you say, are you hiring Ange Postecoglou? Or are you hiring someone who actually wants to be completely different to the Ange Postecoglou who you've hired and who you've known in the last 2 years? Even if you think you're convinced that Ange would play pragmatic, adaptable football next season that would get them through in difficult games. I'm personally not convinced about that, by the way. And we'll see in his next club. Are we going to see Ange as a completely different coach? I personally think it's very unlikely, but let's see. Even if you think he could make that change, why wouldn't you hire someone who's shown over many years that they are capable of doing that at the highest level? Ange has not shown that at Spurs. He's had 2 years. He's had a really good long period of time that a lot of coaches wouldn't get. And he hasn't shown it. And that doesn't mean that Spurs and Spurs fans shouldn't be, you know, hugely appreciative of what's gone on. And I actually think, and maybe we'll get to this, you know, I think Ange's legacy probably, I think history will be very kind to him, because I think people will remember the great times. They'll remember the big wins over Manchester City. They'll remember the great start, the nightclub atmosphere, Robbie Williams' song. They'll remember the trophy parade. They'll remember him on the balcony. In the social media era, all his quotes and all his one-liners will live on forever. They will probably gain more and more traction. I can imagine in 20 years' time, people will talk about Ange Ball like they talk about Ozzy Ardiles now. They'll talk about it as if it was brilliant, swashbuckling football that everyone loved to watch. They will probably forget the kind of the Europa League low block. You know,
I don't know about that.
Like, and I think the Ange Ball legacy will probably get better and better as it goes on. And fine, fair enough. I'm okay with that. But I think right now, in the cold reality of the day, like, they have to make the right decision for the club going forward.
I don't know about that. I mean, at least amongst the Spurs fan base, I think they will remember how this trophy was won, and that will not be lost in time. I think that the sort of change, maybe from the outside, like fans from outside of Spurs might not sort of, who probably didn't even watch the games, won't be aware and just presume he did it, you know, in a certain way. But I think anyone who did watch it, that will be will be remembered to a certain extent. And look, we're in, I'm wondering how to respond and how to take it on. And there's a danger here of like flitting between a bunch of different topics, because one of the questions I wanted to come back with on your point is like, what should Spurs be? What are they expecting to be? Where are they? Where do they fit in? What is their ambition with whoever comes in? But I kind of want to park that and let's try, see if we can come back to that in a minute. While we're talking, you know, sort of assessing this whole situation, I want to bring in the statement that Spurs gave with their relieving of Ange's duties, as they put it, because you and I know from writing up loads of these stories when managers get sacked, you know, you sometimes get the sort of 61 word statement, which is often a sign that there wasn't a lot of love lost, or something that's a bit more effusive of praise. But, you know, Watford, a club you used to cover, I was reading Tom Cleverley's one the other day when he left, and it couldn't have been more effusive of praise for Tom Cleverley after he left. But what you don't often get is them really explaining their thinking in such detail as they did here. So just to read it out, not the whole thing, but after they've gone on about, you know, being grateful to Ange and explained how he will be remembered as the third manager in Spurs' history to win a European trophy, they said the board has unanimously concluded that it is in the best interest of the club for a change to take place. Following a positive start in the 2023-24 Premier League season, when he obviously went 10 games unbeaten, was top of the Premier League, we recorded 78 points from the last 66 Premier League games. Very specific. This culminated in our worst ever Premier League finish last season. At times, there were extenuating circumstances, injuries, and then a decision to prioritise our European campaign, which in itself, we know, was one that was at odds with presumably Daniel Levy, or at least higher-ups at Spurs, because Ange said it himself, that was his plan, wasn't it, after January, and not everyone agreed with it. Whilst winning the Europa League this season ranks as one of the club's greatest moments, we cannot base our decision on emotions aligned to this triumph. It is crucial that we are able to compete on multiple fronts and believe a change of approach will give us the strongest chance for the coming season and beyond. This has been one of the toughest decisions we have had to make, and it is not a decision that we have taken lightly, nor one we have rushed to conclude. We have made what we believe is the right decision to give us the best chance of success going forward, not the easy decision. And then there's a bit more, but that I don't think I've ever read a statement that's like that. And there's a few things to pick out. First of all, Daniel Levy is not quoted, even though the sort of there's obviously more to the statement. Even though the love for Ange in the statement is pretty effusive, I think it's also interesting that there's no quote from Levy, because I can't remember the other sackings gone by if there have been, but there obviously ones. There was one, for example, with Donna Maria Cullen the other day when she left. I mean, they could have easily put that in there, and I find that interesting. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. But the specificity of that statement, particularly the stats trying to back it up, and the fact they said we've gone for what we believe is the right decision, not the easy decision. I suppose, based on what you've said, you probably respect them in a way for the way they've gone about it. I don't even mean that in a sort of your derogatory way. I mean, based on what you said, I almost respect them more for like not, if this is what they really believe, whether I agree with it or not, at least they've had the courage of their convictions, even after the euphoria of actually winning a trophy, to do what they think is right. That's not to say I think it's right, but in a way, wonder if fans will kind of respect them for it, or if they won't see it that way at all.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't the easy decision, was it? The easy decision would have been to stick with Ange at this point, you know. And we said before, didn't we, that there are three options really. One was to sack Ange. One was to keep him, and the other one was to kind of hedge your bets, where you sort of hold on and, but expect turbulence perhaps in the autumn, and you prepare and think maybe you can get someone else, and you don't commit to him too much in this summer transfer window, which I think would have been the worst of all three scenarios. And actually, they've made the hardest one of those three. They've made the hardest call, which was to go against. You know, there'll be loads of people now, you know, journalists who, you know, we respect very much, who will write the articles that say, you know, this is the most Spursy thing you could do, 2 weeks after winning a trophy, to go and sack the manager. You know, there are plenty of people who will write that. And equally, if they'd kept him, there would have been plenty of people saying Spurs are happy to finish 17th. Daniel Levy was in an impossible situation. You know, there are lots of reasons why you can criticise the chairman. But
on this, he was in a really difficult spot. You know, that winning that trophy in Bilbao was probably the best thing and the worst thing that has happened to him in a long time, because it put him in a really difficult spot. And I agree with you, Tom. Like, this, the statement, I think, speaks to that, because they realised that they had to speak to the fans here. They almost have to sort of justify the decision, don't they? Which you never normally see. Like, you very rarely see statements that are basically a case for the defence, really. You know, and I think a lot of it is valid. You know, it's true that since that brilliant start, you know, the 78 points from 66 Premier League games. Well, that's a lot of Premier League games and not many points, you know.
Relegation form, to be fair.
Absolutely. I also think that it is quite instructive. The bit where it's actually not about stats, it's crucial that we are able to compete on multiple fronts and believe a change of approach will give us the strongest chance for the coming season and beyond. That, to me, is talking about injuries. It's talking about conditioning. It's talking about if we are going to compete in the Champions League and also in domestic cups and also mount a challenge for the top five next season in the Premier League, we don't believe that we can do that with Postecoglou's approach. And I think that it's crucial. Like, they don't spell it out in black and white, but I personally think that is the decision that they made, because they think that with the Champions League next season, they won't be able to play how they have been playing this season. You know, they weren't able. Andrew's argument was always flawed, where he said, you know, we had to prioritise the Europa League, which, because clubs like Tottenham, you know, they shouldn't have to prioritise one tournament. They shouldn't have to prioritise winning one Europa League and finishing 17th in the Premier League. They should be able to compete on multiple fronts. And I think that was really a revealing part of the statement.
Hold on. I want to pick you up a little bit here, Tom, because I remember back when, to be honest, I was making the case for the Man City game where he played Wilson Odobert and basically rotated his team. And we were like, there are 8 days to the next match, which was in Europe. I think it was Alkmaar. And Dan and I were both a bit like, I don't really quite get this. And you were making very much the case at the time for, he's totally right, the league's gone, got to prioritise the Europa League. Now, that has gone on to be proved to be successful, as opposed to finishing, what, 12th and not winning it. But I feel, not to, you know, dig you out, you've slightly changed it. I mean, how's that? Doesn't quite stack up with what you just said.
You guys owe me a Europa League trophy. If we had gone with your approach, we'd be finishing 10th and we would have gone out in the quarterfinals. I think there was always a base level. And I think we said at the time, like, it was always going to be difficult for him to juggle the two things. That was always going to be a really difficult task, because you could see that within about two games, the whole thing of playing a rotated lineup, it basically tells the players this isn't as important. And it's really difficult to do that. But I still think it's possible to do it better than Tottenham did it. You know, other teams were doing it. Look at Arsenal, for example. For the last sort of 10 games or whatever it was, they realised the league had gone and they were prioritising the Champions League, right? But they weren't losing every single week. You know, it's possible to prioritise a European tournament and say, yeah, this is where we're going to go now. We're not going to play our best team in the Premier League without imploding like Tottenham did. I mean, blimey, like, they won one game in their last 12 league games, and that was against Southampton at home.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there was a way for Postecoglou to prioritise the Europa League. There should have been a way anyway. Prioritise the Europa League whilst also getting respectable results in the league. You know, I think people would have... That ultimately was his path to staying on, was winning the tournament in Europa and finishing 11th. You know, if they'd finished 11th and they'd won, let's say, you know, two or three of their last six or seven games, I think he'd still be in a job, don't you think?
Well, we did say there was more of an importance than it probably looked from the outside on having a strong finish, because, and it references it in that statement, a lot of the poor form in the winter at the time could kind of be explained away by the injuries, but they started to sort of ease up, albeit he still had lots towards the end anyway. There was still some, and obviously in the final he was missing all his creative midfielders, but there were still enough players to not be losing every week in the league, I do think that was critical. I personally I don't I again I come back to it I still think the game is about winning, and he managed to win something. And yes, you can make lots of cases. Your point you just made about Arsenal, I can already hear Spurs fans going, but Arsenal won nothing. But obviously, it's all about context. They were in the Champions League. They went out to the eventual winners, and not just winners, but like the team that actually battered Inter in the final. So they had, in the Champions League at least, Arsenal had a good season. It's just, it's so close. You know, it's toss up a coin a lot of the time when it comes to actually winning these trophies, but I also think, Tom, the thing is that
if you think that, let's say the Europa League didn't exist, let's say they lost to AZ Alkmaar in the, whatever it was, last 16, where would Tottenham have finished? They wouldn't have finished fourth. They would have finished somewhere between eighth at best and 12th, which for a lot of Tottenham managers is a sackable offence in itself. I mean, we're not talking about the Europa League, you know, being the difference between them, you know, finishing the Champions League places. Like it would have been the difference between them finishing somewhere in the middle of the table. So, I mean, even if they had not gone down this road of playing their, you know, fringe players in kind of March, April, I mean, January is exaggerating it, by the way. Like if you look at the lineups they were playing in sort of late February, early March, he was still playing some of their best players. It was only in April, really, when they really started to leave out all of the best players in the team. But even if they hadn't done that, where were Tottenham destined to finish? They were destined to finish in the middle of the table. And that in itself could have led to Postecoglou going. The difference between mid-table and the top three or top four was the injuries, of course. If Tottenham had their best team out every single week, I have no doubt they would have been somewhere between third and fifth, sixth, you know, like... Of course, but injuries are part of the game now. That is part of it. It's a huge part. It's the difference, isn't it? Like you look at the Premier League this season, the teams that have done well have generally been the coaches who have managed to rotate, to rest, to preserve. The game is all about squad management now. So I find the prioritisation thing a little bit of a red herring, because although it's obviously key to why they finished 17th, it's not the key to why they didn't finish third or fourth.
No, and back to your point about squad management, I mean, Ange often made the point when talking about Liverpool about how Slot had a lot of fit players. And I do think, you know, he would obviously push back on his culpability, whether, you know, or the accused culpability of his intensity of training, style of play, contributing to the amount of injuries. But the fact that it happened at Celtic and has happened in previous clubs means that will probably be a tag that he'll have to deal with going forward. And you're right. I would imagine played quite a big role in this deciding factor. But I still come back to, I mean, it's not just winning a trophy, albeit that is the absolute holy grail for Spurs fans, at least. But he also, through doing that, got them back into the Champions League. Now, you could go down the Arsene Wenger route of saying it was a bit of a backdoor route that maybe shouldn't have been open to him. But ultimately, if it comes down to finance, then he's done it through there. So I see your argument. And I don't disagree to a certain extent, really. And it might be a bit vibes based, but and I think part of it also, I want to come back to Ange and sort of reflections on his tenure, because I don't want to skip over that. But it's quite hard not to like skip over to what's next when talking a lot about this stuff. So a big part of my sort of reluctance, or impartial reluctance, apart from being maybe slightly keen towards Ange himself, but as a non-Spurs fan, is that I don't see any obvious, like, unbelievable candidates out there that you're making this change for. Now, Thomas Frank is the front runner right now, and it seems like he is most likely. And it's probably going to be between Marco Silva. My understanding is Silva's probably dropped back a bit in that. It is probably most likely Thomas Frank if they can do a deal. Sounds like he's not going to be cheap to get out of Brentford. They're already paying off Ange, obviously. It's going to cost a lot. And I think Thomas Frank, firstly, from the media point of view, which obviously Spurs fans don't care about, but he's perfect. That would be great. Don't think anyone will be ever better than Ange, but Thomas Frank is fantastic on that front. But I also think he really deserves it. He really deserves a shot. He's done brilliant. He's worked wonders at Brentford. He's improved play. Every metric you can think of, apart from some people sort of accuse him of playing quite direct football, but one could argue he did that because of, Brentford being a sort of, well, should be a lower end Premier League team, if Premier League team at all. So who's to say he can't adapt? So I see him as, if he gets it, he totally deserves it. But it's not like when Antonio Conte took over when they managed to convince him after Nuno left, where even though it didn't work out, he was a winner. He was a massive, it's not just a massive name, like he had won Serie A just before. It wasn't like, you know, a faded name like ultimately Jose Mourinho kind of proved to be. Conte had recent success at the highest level. And if there was someone like that out there that they were looking to bring in, you could really understand it. But the fact that there isn't really anyone like that makes me even more, if it was already you sort of slightly on the fence of doing this in the first place, it's not, as someone coming from an impartial perspective, I don't really see the risk from that point of view. And you know, Levy, as we know, is not, it's understatement to say he's not popular with the fans. We've been at all the games. We've seen the protests, particularly the one ahead of that Man United game, the 1-0. Obviously, they beat them so many times this season when that absolute army of fans marching on Tottenham Hotspur Stadium and the euphoria after the parade. I mean, he's got like the thickest skin ever, hasn't he, really, to make this decision. And clearly is unfazed by how he will be perceived. But it's you know, fair play in a way, really. I mean, how do you see it? Do you understand my logic about there not being like a sort of stellar candidate that sort of forces your hand in this situation?
Yeah, I do. I think it's a completely valid argument. You know, I mean, I would say that, you know, Conte looked like the best coach that Tottenham could ever have and didn't prove to be like that. Mourinho, obviously, as well, you know. And I think as journalists, sometimes we see these things in slightly kind of broad brushstrokes, whereas you would hope that the people making decisions have a deeper and more detailed insight. For example, I know that Frank comes out very well in the kind of data tables that sporting directors like to look at when they make these kind of decisions in terms of overperformance, you know, in terms of how the teams play and in comparison to, you know, wages and spend and ability. The amount he gets out of his players and his teams, I think, puts him always very high up on the kind of data tables, presumably the ones that Johan Lang spends most of his day kind of poring over. But it's true. I mean, I personally have, all the managers that I've kind of wanted Tottenham to get have always been terrible. I was like hugely in favour of them getting Louis van Gaal back in the day, and that turned out badly for Man United. Like, I thought Conte was a brilliant appointment for them. It didn't turn out that way. I think I was on
said that got them in the Champions League.
Yeah,
got them in the Champions League. I mean, it's all as Spurs. I suppose this is part of what the point I want to make about what you hope their ambitions are. But no one really lasts very long, no matter what. So you have to like assess their tenure in the hole. It ended terribly, but it wasn't all bad, I guess, for Conte.
And I guess historically you look at it and you think, well, look, when Spurs signed Poch in 2014, people were not, you know, riveted by that. I think that was actually when they went for Van Gaal. They were trying to get Van Gaal and they didn't get him in the January, I think. And then in the summer they got Poch instead and everyone was like, you know, really? The Southampton manager who doesn't speak very good English? Like, equally, Martin Jol was the assistant manager, you know, for Jack Santini, you know, and he was kind of put in there as a sort of a stopgap. Turned out to be a really good appointment who everyone loved. You know, I think managers, even more so than players, are not always the obvious picks. You know, that's what I would say. But I do agree with you that the layout of the options, you know, I personally like Iraola, but it looks like he's happy to stay at Bournemouth. I think Thomas Frank has a lot going for him, but equally, you know, who knows? I agree. There isn't an obvious appointment. But, you know, let's see. I mean, Tom, where do you think the kind of like, where do you think the kind of, if you look back now, when do you think, what were the key staging posts for Postecoglou, you know, the end of him? What do you think were the kind of key moments in the last kind of 6 months, I guess, that you sort of felt when it sort of started to change your mind in terms of where this was going? Do you remember were there certain matches that stuck out for you? Was it the kind of the ear cupping to the fans, or what do you think were the key bits that really brought him down?
I mean, I've been going through it this whole season, really, and there are lots of moments that stick out. I remember the Bournemouth 1-0 away, which is a really drab performance where the fans at the end of the game, very rainy night, I think it was around the 5th of December, and Dean Huijsen, who's he has moved to Real Madrid since, hasn't he? But at the time, I think no one really knew much about him. Scored this the most simple header from a set piece, and Spurs really stank the place out that night. They were really poor, and at the end of the game, the fans who had rarely got angry with Postecoglou seemed to take real issue with him not going over to them to sort of, you know, engage. And they started getting angry with him. And I remember Jed Spence going over sort of as peacemaker at the time. And that was the first sort of all grumblings of like people not being particularly happy. I mean, other games that stick out, Everton away when they were 3-0 down at halftime. And I really thought if this gets any worse in this game, he could get sacked after this. It's that bad. And they drew it back to 3-2. But the fans weren't happy after that. Some of the defeats like Ipswich. Leicester hadn't won for seven games. They lost seven games in a row. They somehow won at Spurs, despite going behind with the sort of two goals in the first five minutes or whatever in the second half. Which again, you know, they couldn't get it back at that point. Spurs, despite having most of the second half, and having this, and then Leicester went on to lose the next eight games without scoring a goal. I think it was, which really underlined like how bad that result was. Brighton, where they went 2-0 up at halftime and flying actually quite early on in the season, and then suddenly end up losing 3-2 in second half. I mean, there are so many poor performances in the Premier League, but then he won the Europa League. So,
I think that time when they had the key players coming back, because I felt like there was that week, wasn't there, with the Brentford, Liverpool, Villa. They had the FA Cup and the Carabao Cup week, where it was all about can they get to the final, and what will it be like when they get the best players back. And Ange, they'd obviously had those two really disappointing defeats against Villa and Liverpool, and you know they were really on their knees. But the idea was, you know, and I remember Ange saying in the press conference at Villa Park. Do you remember that press conference where he sort of said, I have no doubt when we get our best players back, we'll be an outstanding team again.
Yeah.
And he was sort of saying, wasn't he, do you expect us to press?
Said it to you, wasn't he? Said it to you, didn't he? You asked him the question.
I think, to be fair, like, you know, do you expect us to press, you know, when we're playing with these players sort of thing? And he really built up this idea that, don't worry, in a few weeks when we have our big men back, we'll be a brilliant team again. And briefly, there was a flicker because they beat Man United 1-0 at home. They went away to Ipswich and won 4-1, which was slightly flattering. And they lost, yeah, and they that game 1-0 at home to City, where actually they played okay. You know, it wasn't the result they wanted, but they played all right, I thought, in the match. And the real one where I remember I didn't go, I remember you all coming back from AZ Alkmaar, and you all just were just a completely different mood and tone to the pod, to your faces, even your hair looked a bit disheveled. You look like different people. And you know, I just felt like the mood of the whole thing had shifted in that game, because I think they went away in that match and just played so badly, lost the match, but also were playing their best players. They had their team back, and it was like, actually, this isn't going to be the quick fix that Ange said it would be. And I thought that was just that was a key moment, I thought, in the last few moments.
I'd be intrigued to know. I don't know how listeners would get in touch, but how much they felt that game was a big moment. But then again, but it was in the Europa League, which they ultimately won. So maybe it wasn't as big a deal. But it did really feel like at the time, because it was off the back of the Man City game, where we'd had this pod that I've already referenced earlier, you know, about the controversial rotating of players in a Premier League game where at that point they had loads of games left. It could have still kind of meant something. I think if they had an unbelievable run, they could have somehow climbed the league into a sort of European position, which was never going to happen. But that was why there was controversy around it, given there was also, I think, 8 days between that game and the Alkmaar game. And so, but yet he decided to rotate it and try and get some, you know, some minutes into players' legs in akin to a sort of pre-season friendly approach, which happened a lot more and more after that. And then it didn't even seem to be worth it at all, because they absolutely were awful, and Alkmaar very lucky to only lose 1-0. And if they had lost by more, they might not have been able to turn it round in the second leg, but obviously they did. I mean, it was just so, I mean, this is this is the madness of Ange's season. I mean, the 4-3 at home to Chelsea seemed quite huge because he made two massive choices in bringing Romero and Van de Ven back for that game, which no one saw coming, and they completely backfired because they both went off injured and were out for a considerable amount of time after that.
Yeah.
And just the way Chelsea came back, because Spurs actually went 2-0 up, and the way Chelsea came back to go 4-2 up and absolutely bossed it. I know Spurs scored again later on, but you know, it could have been more than that. Obviously losing 6-3 at home to Liverpool when they were 5-1 down at one point was, you know, obviously Liverpool were absolutely purring at that point, but that was tough to take. You know, obviously losing to Ipswich at home. Ipswich, actually, looking back, Ipswich at home was quite key because when you look at the fixtures, yes, they lost to Newcastle and Arsenal early doors, and it kind of put them on the back foot because we went into the season, do you remember, we were sort of saying, well, Ange had a bad end to last season, really, and there was a fraying of the relationship with the supporters over the whole Man City game, where, you know, about whether to deny Arsenal the league title or not. And we felt like he needed a good start to the season. And I thought they actually played really well against Leicester, but ended up drawing. They battered Everton, and then they played well at Newcastle, but lost. They played okay against Arsenal without really laying a glove, and obviously conceded set piece for Gabriel. Yeah, and it was quite a touch point that game because it was the one where he came out afterwards and said the whole I always win things in my second season, and obviously Johnson also deactivated his social media off the back of that, and he turned out to be like a real, you know, obviously one that was match winner in the final. But after that, they actually went on a 5-game winning streak. Yes, they then lost at Brighton, but they picked it up again with wins over West Ham, Alkmaar. Then they lost at Palace, but then they picked it up again by beating City in the League Cup and battering Villa at home 4-1, which is no mean feat. Then they go to lose Galatasaray 3-2. And by now, the injuries are starting to creep up. He rotated massively against Galatasaray. And it didn't really matter because, you know, I think he was looking at it, thinking, well, we can get through. This is probably my toughest game in the Europa League sort of group phase, and I can sort of risk rotating my team. And the scoreline massively flattered them. Victor Osimhen destroyed Spurs that night, and it could have easily been 7 or 8-1 if Forster had a good game. And they follow it up with that defeat at home to Ipswich, who hadn't won a game all season in the Premier League. And at that point, Spurs were actually in touching distance, I think, of like the top three. And obviously it's early doors, it's only November, but they're doing okay. They've had some wobbles, but they're doing okay. But injuries are starting to creep up. And that felt huge. Albeit, obviously, they followed up with the 4-0 win at Man City, which was an amazing result. But in a way, that Ipswich result was the start of where it started to go pear-shaped. But just finally, funny enough, I suppose Spurs fans will remember Bilbao most, I imagine, when it comes to Ange because of winning the trophy. But I wonder if most fans, because he beyond Spurs, because Ange was one of those figures that sort of transcended their club. I think he's someone that everyone had an opinion on, everyone was interested in. And not just because Spurs did well at the start, because of his unorthodox route. It was into getting to the Premier League. It was just the way things he said and the way he said them. People were always interested, and they, you know, you can just tell by the amount of reams of copy we were writing for the newspapers as a result. But I think the game that he might best be remembered for was the 4-1 against Chelsea in the first season. It was the one that. It changed everything. Everything was never really the same after it, but it was an absolute... I talked about him being a bit of a unicorn of a manager. It was a unicorn of a game. It was one that you'll probably never see again. You know, Spurs, I think... If I can remember right, I can't even remember now, but I think they took the lead against Poch's Chelsea. I've forgotten about the fact that Poch was the manager at the time. They lose players to injury and big injuries, as it turned out, in Van de Ven and Madison with ankle ligaments. And I don't... Were you at the game that night? Because it was really cold and there was all these delays with VAR, with goals being ruled out. And who knows if it contributed to Van de Ven's hamstring, but you wouldn't be surprised if it was the case. But obviously they go two men down with Romero and the dog getting sent off, and he carries on attacking. And it almost pays off with Sonny going through and Dier scoring a goal that's disallowed. And then Jackson scores, you know, what's dubbed the worst hat-trick ever. And they're applauded off with a standing ovation. It's just... unbelievable game, which in a nutshell summed up probably not what he ended up being in being successful and winning the trophy in any way, but summed up what people have in their minds when they think of Postecoglou. A sort of, you know, I suppose glorious failure is a horrible way of putting it, but like it was an unforgettable way of essentially being thrashed 4-1, but one that I don't think anyone will forget in a hurry. I mean, what do you think? Do you agree with me on that point?
It's a great point. Yeah, like it's easy to kind of think about the last 6 months, but that the two Chelsea games, weirdly, but also that first one in November 2023. Just a really surreal football match, you know, where you were watching, you know, the white shirts hugging the halfway line and Chelsea were just literally chipping the ball over the top and going through for one-on-one every 5 minutes, it felt like. And, you know, it's remarkable now, I think, how many people, you know, my friends or people on the desk at the Times, you know, they talk about Ange and they're not perhaps quite as kind of plugged into the sort of everyday of Tottenham. You know, they'll still quote, you know, it's who we are, mate. They'll still remember that high line. Like I've seen pictures on Twitter, you know, even in the last, you know, few hours of that high line of Eric Dier and Porro and Udogi and Romero sort of hugging the halfway line and sticking to that tactic. You know, you're right. That was the match that kind of made Postecoglou famous, I think, in the Premier League. It was the thing that kind of drew him to everyone's attention. And I think about his, you know, what his legacy will be. I always think that everything Ange did was always judged in extremes, wasn't it? It was always about kind of all or nothing. You know, it was always champions or flops. It was always like he's either this genius who's kind of, you know, come from Australia and gone through Japan, or he's this sort of, you know, complete fraud and, you know, clown, imposter, you know, whatever you want to call it. You know, it was always this kind of sense of all or nothing, you know. And I think actually that was partly our fault in the media, but I also think he played into that, you know, with his tactics, the way he was such a high wire coach and in the way that he wanted to play, in his rhetoric, in the way that he talked. I think everything was very much all or nothing. You never had a boring press conference. Everything was always, you know, really, really high narrative about kind of fairy tales and stories. And so he played into that. But I Definitely. Wonder just in time whether once, you know, we kind of move away from the sort of the heat and the emotion of it all, whether actually we'll look back on the sort of Postecoglou 2 year period between Conte and Frank or whoever it is, and we'll say, you know, that was just a period of real transition for Tottenham, where they ditched the whole Pochettino era, you know, where Kane left, Lloris left, Dier left, you know, all these really big players, these big personalities and figures basically left. And they brought in, you know, Bergvall and Gray and the players who basically formed the next era. And obviously the transition of style as well, you know, to move away from Conte and Mourinho and into this kind of much more modern progressive style, of course, you know, with its own extremities. But ultimately, this is probably how Spurs want to play. You know, and actually, the kind of irony of it all is that the Postecoglou all or nothing thing is actually just more of a kind of a bridge. You know, it's like a transition period. And maybe if they get someone in next who they can sort of marry up to some extent with those principles, it can actually serve to be quite a continuous kind of process. It doesn't have to be something that was just kind of a all about the trophy in Bilbao and nothing else. It can actually be something that can serve to kind of to make a platform, right? I don't know if you think that or whether you think it stops here. Like, I mean, was the kind of Bilbao trophy an end or could it be a beginning for the club?
Well, this is the thing. And you mentioned all these, this transition with these young players coming in. I mean, this is another thing that he will feel hard done by, because his style has been written off as basically not being fit for purpose. It won't work long term, and that's why they want to make a change. And yet he had three teenagers signed for him in the summer, and they are going to get better, and they already have. And do you remember that press conference? I don't know if you were there for it, where he sort of basically pleaded. He said he hoped to God that he was the one who would benefit from these players when they come to maturity, when the fruits of their labor turn them into top players. And that was a while ago. I almost wonder then if he sort of knew he was maybe on thin ice, perhaps, and that might have been a hint. Mm. To be fair, but. So in a way, I feel for him because, you know, next season, I imagine Lucas Bergvall particularly will be, a really good player. I think because the season's been so bad to a certain extent with the Premier League, Bergvall's been the crumb of comfort for a lot of people. But if he was a 28-year-old with the performances he put in, I don't think anyone would be really saying anything about him. It's the fact that he's so young, come from this Swedish league and put in some really sparkling performances at times, particularly the Liverpool home game in the Carabao Cup, that everyone's getting really, really excited. Now is when he really kicks on, hopefully, once he's over his injury. And hopefully there's likes for Archie Gray as well, who, you know, the next manager. I mean, if it is Thomas Frank, I mean, it looks like he wanted to sign him for Brentford. So hopefully that bodes well for Archie going forward. And I do think Archie Gray is probably one of the misses of Postecoglou's tenure. He was only 18 and he did play him loads, but we sort of left and just left without us really knowing where Gray still fits in with this whole setup. What is his best position and where his development is. But that's a sort of side point. But I don't know. This is kind of a point that I wanted to ask you. As a Tottenham fan and as someone who's covered the club for a long time, it's sort of this question that kind of gets to the heart of this sacking and the sort of merits or the sort of foolhardiness, if that's a word, of doing it, is like, what do Spurs expect to be? What do they expect to be in the modern environment? With the money that Newcastle have now and the other clubs that are already established and Man United, who are terrible, who have just spent 62.5 million on Matheus Cunha. And you know what? It might click. So therefore, there'll be another competitor going forward. Like, it's not to say, like, here's just to sort of almost denigrate Spurs by Spurs and Spurs fans saying, like, this is your lot. You know, be happy with it. You've won a trophy. But it doesn't happen that often. And when you finally win something, I mean, I do see why people are saying, oh, this is the Spursiest thing ever to a certain extent. I know it might sound like an easy thing to write. And I know you've made a lot of valid points, but to a certain extent, I kind of get it. Like, you have finally won something. And yes, it wasn't perfect. And yes, there are so many things that he would, if he was given the chance, needed to prove he could do them better. Yeah. But now was the chance. Where do you think Spurs can really strive for, and where can a Thomas, what would be a good season next year, for example? Thomas Frank comes in, if he finishes seventh and wins nothing, is that actually a pretty good season from Spurs' point of view?
I think the thing is with Spurs now is I think they have to use the fact that they've won a trophy to go and win more, you know, and that doesn't mean going and winning the Premier League. I think Tottenham fans are realistic about that. You know, they're not expecting Spurs to finish first, even second. They're not expecting them to finish third even. They're expecting them to challenge in the cups, you know, to go further in the cups than they have in the last few years, where they've, you know, we've seen them just kind of toss away the Carabao and the FA Cup countless times, you know, and they don't need to do that. You see the clubs that win these tournaments. It's possible to win them if you put priority in them. And we said, to be fair, I think in the last two or three years, that the Europa League has been won by clubs like Sevilla and Eintracht Frankfurt,
yeah,
you know, because they, you know, put their eggs in that basket and they go for it. It should also be possible, I think, for Spurs to balance that with, you know, decent league campaigns, you know, where they are in the, you know, it's true that the landscape has now changed in the Premier League, but we're no longer in the kind of top big four era. We're now in the era of the big eight. And plus, by the way, you know, three or four really good teams below that who have really good players like Brian Mbeumo and, you know, Dean Howson. And, you know, they have really good coaches. Like, the Premier League is now so much more open than it's ever been. The big clubs have far fewer guarantees than they've ever had before. And clubs like Spurs and Aston Villa and Newcastle and even Man United and Chelsea are all going to have to suck up the fact that they're not going to get in the Champions League every year like they used to. Like, it's just not going to happen. Aston Villa, really good team this year, really good team. And probably in a lot of previous bygone eras of the Premier League, they would have finished third or fourth. They didn't get in because it's a completely different league now. And all of those teams have to accept that. So I think Spurs fans, and I don't speak for them, you know, I'm sure lots of people have different views on this, but I think Spurs fans have seen the club qualify for the Champions League over and over again, get to the quarterfinals, get to the last 16. And it's fun. You know, everyone wants to be playing the best teams in Europe. But ultimately, I think Spurs fans would rather see the team in the top six, in the top seven,
and challenging for the cups, getting to finals, winning the odd domestic cup every 2 or 3 years, then they would just routinely finishing in the top four every single season. But that doesn't mean, Tom, before you start furrowing your brow, that doesn't mean finishing 17th. It doesn't mean finishing 17th, because everyone can see that Tottenham were 90 minutes away from having absolutely nothing this season. You know, if they'd lost that final to Manchester United, which they could easily have done, you know, both teams didn't play particularly well. If they'd lost that game, they would have finished 17th, and they would have been nowhere in any of the cups either. So they have to have some kind of balance there. There has to be a serious team where they can say, yeah, we're progressing, we play attractive football, we challenge for the European places in the league, and we also push in the cups. And maybe that sounds like you want everything. I personally think that should be possible, you know. And I think it is, when you're talking before about the squad, I think there's a point here to mention as well, which is that, excuse me, the big unknown, and we'll never know it, the big question I always have with Andrew is, what would he have been like with a deeper squad? You know, if they'd had a squad, if they'd known, you know, and this is Mr. Hindsight, if they'd known at the beginning, Ange Postecoglou's methods are going to give us muscle injuries unless we rotate players pretty regularly and give them rest. If they'd known that and they'd made a deeper squad, if they'd signed a good backup for Van de Ven or whatever, if they'd signed Eze in midfield, would the team have been able to cope, you know, on multiple fronts? Would that have made a big difference? Because ultimately, the real crux of this was the combination of Ange's methods and his attitude towards conditioning and injuries, and marrying that with the club not giving him a deep enough squad to nullify the effect of that. You know, if they'd signed 3 or 4 really good players last summer more and given him more options, would that have made a difference? We'll never know.
I think that's a really, really good point, because I'm pretty sure I know that I know for a fact that he wanted more experienced players. I mean, I think he said it publicly, particularly in January, and essentially they only got Kevin Danzo, who fitted that mould. Kinski came in, Matisse Tell, you know, both youngsters and unproven.
And late, by the way. It wasn't until the last week,
exactly. Yeah, and last summer,
you know, 2 or 3 more games.
I mean, and last summer, I mean, obviously Solanke is massive, and there's no getting away from how heavily he was backed with Solanke. He wanted him really badly, felt he was the right man. He cost 65 million. He was the most expensive signing in the Premier League. So let's give Daniel Levy and Spurs their due on that front. But the rest of them were teenagers, and Timo Werner, who I think he was saying at the time. And when they had the chance to loan him again, I thought he'd had performed pretty well when he came in the first time. And my argument was like, I don't think he's a bad signing. I just don't. My issue is the old economics opportunity cost. What are you not? This means you're not going to buy someone else, right? You're not going to loan someone else. But if it is him or not, nothing, I don't think it's a bad purchase. He was so much worse than I really expected. And I think that really let him down when it came to the senior professionals. And he clearly got to Ange, that in particular, because if you remember the Rangers game, I don't know if you were at Ibrox, but it was the one time he really threw a player under the bus, even though he said, you know, himself, he said it was just feedback. But, you know, it was a real strong criticism, in public criticism of a player. You know, obviously he was on loan, so maybe it was easier to do that. But one of the points in that was about him being a senior player, played for Germany, blah, blah, blah. He made the point, this is one of my experienced players and he's not performing well enough at all. So I think in that, looking back, that almost was another indication of the frustration there of not having, of having to rely on so many youngsters, as talented as they were. I definitely think from the club's point of view, they will have looked at it and thought, there are too many injuries going on here with assets, multi-million pound assets, youngsters who are supposed to appreciate in value. And not to say they're not, but obviously the more injured they get, the more that puts that at risk. So in a sort of cold hard business approach, which is essentially what this sacking has been, you can sort of understand that logic if they put the blame down to him for that being the case. Again, he would push back on whether he was culpable or not, but I would not be surprised, as you so well point out, if that was the case. I suppose, sort of to sum up, really, a sort of very basic, almost binary yes or no question is, will Spurs look back on this in a few, I mean, obviously, again, it's crystal ball time, rather than Mr. Hindsight. What's the opposite of that? Crystal ball. But do you think they'll end up regretting this or not? Will they go back? You know, are we going to be 5 years' time? Spurs have basically done nothing ever since. But you know, obviously stayed in the Premier League and performed better and maybe qualified for a bit of Europe, but never won anything since. Probably gone through a couple of managers because that's generally been the history under the ownership. And will they go back? Well, we sacked the guy who actually won something. Because obviously that's not how anyone thinks back about Wando Ramos, to be fair, in fairness. They don't think that way about him. No, are they going to see us as a Wando Ramos? Are they going to see us as a Wando Ramos? Or are they going to go, my God, we got rid of the guy who actually finally won something in a season where it was all going pear-shaped, had loads of injuries, and we never gave him a chance to actually see if he could change and improve? It doesn't sound like you think that will be the case.
I mean, I think no one misses Wando Ramos, but it's a different scenario for two reasons. One, Harry Redknapp came in and did a really good job. You know, no matter what some Spurs fans think about Redknapp, he did a really good job, and so that immediately kind of dismissed those memories. Two, Wando Ramos didn't have an inch of the charisma and you know chispa that Postecoglou has. You know, I think people will miss him. You know, even people who think it's the right decision will miss Ange. You know, I think they'll miss him as a figure, as a leader, as a figurehead for the club. So I'm sure people will look back wistfully in the future. And I think I've sort of wrestled with this thing, you know, is it going to weigh heavy on the next coach a little bit? You know, the idea that a lot of fans, you know, didn't want this decision. Some of the players probably didn't want this decision. I know that some of them were, you know, pretty fed up with the regime as well. I don't agree with this thing that the whole squad was suddenly unanimously behind Ange. It's a typical football dressing room. There are some players who absolutely loved him, some players who were done with it, you know, so... But there will be, I'm sure, whether with this, you know, that could be a difficult context. Equally, I think that footballers and managers always back themselves to better their predecessors. You know, they have big egos and they'll think they can do a better job. The question I thought you were going to ask, Tom, is, you know, do we think Ange was a success? You know, if we look back now and think when they appointed him back in 2023, you know, in his first game after Harry Kane was sold, and I predicted they would finish 12th or something, you know, in that season after Harry Kane left, you know, would we have taken this? Would we have said in 2 years' time, this will be what will happen, 5th and 17th? They would have won the Europa League, but all the injuries, et cetera, et cetera. Would you have taken that? Or would you have said, actually, we expected more?
I think definitely it is a success in the context of Tottenham Hotspur under Daniel Levy and the lack of trophies and the managerial turnover. Not many last that long anyway. As Ange himself has pointed out, again, in one of those comments that hinted at a sort of slightly more frank way of speaking about the ownership post the international break, which again hinted at that maybe things was coming to an end, even back in March or whatever. But yeah, I think in that regard, yes. Yeah, it's interesting. Like you got the Poch era, which won nothing, but were one of the best teams in the country and went so close and got to the Champions League final. But although you don't even really think, I mean, I guess that was like the sort of standout feat, but it's actually a couple of years before where the team was unbelievable, wasn't it really? That was a really, really consistently brilliant team. So we're not near that. So it's not just because you won a trophy, you can sort of hold a candle to that era personally, but it's still a big success. It's still, for me, again, without my sort of Tottenham fan hat on and my probably lack of remembering each every moment under the last 25 years, you know, from an emotional point of view, like I can probably pick out moments from Newcastle from the whole time of following them. It will, but even with that in mind, I still sort of sits above quite a few of the other times, like AVB, for example. To me, as a neutral, and I know this is obviously recency bias, and I actually cover the club, so I live in this environment all the time, but that's a forgettable era for me completely, whereas this will live long. But then I'm probably the wrong person to speak to. This is what I deal with on a daily basis, 24/7 basis now, so it's always in my head.
You dismissed too easily Gareth Bale's fantastic season under AVB. That was the main highlight of the AVB tenure.
That is a good point. I've completely exposed myself as knowing nothing about Tottenham history. Yeah, obviously that was unbelievable that season.
Sorry, go on.
No, that is correct. I mean, I definitely remember Bale. I suppose I didn't really think of ABB, to be fair. But yeah, all right. Bad.
No, but otherwise it's a fair comment. You don't remember that tenure particularly fondly apart from Bale. That's basically what I'm saying. It was essentially a one-man team. And my other question then is where do we think Ange goes next? I don't think this is the last chapter for Ange. You know, it was obviously a kind of a fairy tale ending in the Ange story. But do we think we'll see him again in the Premier League? Do we think he's going to go somewhere in Europe? Do we think he's going to take a long break and become a TV pundit at the World Cup or a columnist for The Sun? Or what's his next move?
Well, I'll definitely be trying to hit him up and if I can get hold of it, you know, get in contact somehow to try and get him to be a columnist if he fancies it, definitely. But
why you've been so pro him in your obituaries, isn't it? You've been trying to line
please,
him up.
Please be one of our columnists. I'm led to believe that he wants to get back in pretty soon, to be honest. I don't imagine unless he's not afforded an opportunity, he will be looking for a break. You know, if he's at the age where if he wants to carry on managing, presumably he wants to get on with it rather than wait around. I've been thinking about this question for a while, and I do really genuinely think that the Europa League victory is a massive factor in this, because if he hadn't won it, which kind of undermines my whole argument of why I think he should have been given a chance to stay, but I almost couldn't make a case for hardly any Premier League team, because if you're obviously one of the top teams, they would have looked at how it went for Spurs and thought no chance. If you're a middling team, say even like a Crystal Palace, if they'd lost Oliver Glasner, or a West Ham, great example, because West Ham, Karen Brady in The Sun, famously before he came to Tottenham, Postecoglou had written this, what was described as a bit of a love letter, a column about how great Postecoglou was when he was at Celtic, kind of out of nowhere. So clearly she was a fan, at least based on this column. But would West Ham want him now? Well, West Ham are one of those middling clubs that if they get it wrong, could get relegated. There is a risk if they really sort of mess it up. Like I would say a Palace, even though they're really well run. That's why it's so important. Like, you know, Frank de Boer would be a prime example of that, albeit the squad is in a much better place now, but then they always sell a lot of their good players. So those kind of clubs, I don't really see it. It's almost more like a promoted team. But it would have to be sort of big enough for him to be attracted to. I mean, Leeds would have been a really interesting shout, and maybe it remains to be so. There has been so much sort of debate over Farker as soon as he got promoted, and there was, you know, a lot of speculation that they might sack him straight away. They come out saying that they'll keep him. I have no idea at all whether that might have been because of fan pressure or if that's what they plan to do, whatever. But if they have a bad start, you know, he does have Bielsa vibes at times, doesn't he, Postecoglou? That may be them. And for a team where they're... But even like a Leeds, when they get promoted, they've probably, mainly just because of their history, rather than like the reality of what it's like to try and transition from the Championship to the Premier League, as proven in the last couple of seasons, how difficult that is. They may have eyes thinking that they definitely should stay up. And if they go with someone that they think is a bit more of a risk, maybe that might not even be appealing. So personally, I would expect... it's hard with, isn't it? Because normally you just think of Europe, but because of Ange's history, I mean, it could literally be anywhere in the world, but probably a sort of kind of glamorous name in like maybe Holland or Portugal or somewhere like that. But it would have to be one of the stronger teams who sort of dominate the league. Maybe, yeah, almost like Bobby Robson when he went and took over, I think it was PSV after leaving Barcelona, I think, back in the day. You know, someone like that, where he'll be one of the better teams that are expected to win, kind of like with Celtic in Scotland, and that's where maybe he can get going again. But then it also could be someone completely random, because he's got that sort of romance about him. I mean, didn't he famously say he enjoyed playing Football Manager? And it's got, you know, picking up a sort of random team from Eastern Europe and taking them all the way to the Champions League written all over it. Probably not. I mean, he's obviously at a much higher stock now, so I'm not meaning it in a sort of belittling way. But my point being is the sort of romance about him. You could almost see a left field choice like Bielsa might have done compared to your average manager.
Yeah, like maybe one of kind of the old European greats, like Benfica or something, or, you know, like a Feyenoord, or I don't know. But I agree with you. Leeds was Marseille. On my mind as well. I don't, Marseille, yeah, exactly, yeah. But I guess the English thing, I mean, you know, Postecoglou is so much about rhetoric and what he says, isn't he? But I wonder if the language is important.
I agree the Leeds thing came through a translator, well, you know. He worked in Japan through a translator, so I don't think that would faze him, to be fair.
No, that's true. I mean, going back to Celtic, I think it would always be an option. You know, they obviously still love him there. I think it's a shame, though, because I've sort of been wondering about this the last few months, whether, you know, maybe Ange just missed a step, you know? Like, maybe if he'd gone to a Brighton or a Fulham, and we know Brighton really looked at him really hard, you know, and I think it was post-Potter, they really had him on their list. And ironically, they actually red flagged his public persona a bit. They researched his, you know, his personality. And
interesting.
Yeah, and they were slightly nervous about it, I think, you know, given the kind of scrutiny of the Premier League. I'm not saying that's not...
And they hired Deserby instead.
Yeah, true. But I just wonder if at those clubs, like in the middle of the Premier League, where obviously most of the time there isn't European football to contend with, where the pressure is slightly less to kind of win every week, maybe, and maybe, you know, that's slightly unfair, but I think that's true. And also, to be honest, at some of those teams like Brentford, Brighton, Palace, particularly at the moment, where most things are run very well. You know, we know that Postecoglou is like a chief executive almost. He delegates to the departments where he says, you know, you're the experts, you take charge of those things, leave me to deal with the first team and the football coaching, you do everything else. I wonder if he would have been really well fit, a really good fit for a club in the middle of the Premier League that was well run like that, and whether that actually would have been the perfect job for him. And I agree with you. I don't think he'll get that job now, because I think there are too many teams in the Premier League that will look at the relegation zone and think that, you know, Tottenham's plunge down the table could easily happen to them and there wouldn't be a way back for them. But I think it's a shame that we might never find out, because I actually think he could have been a really compelling and entertaining manager for one of those teams. But I hope we see him again in the league, you know, and I kind of hope, you know, nothing against Daniel Farke, but I would love it if Leeds, you know, went for Postecoglou in October, November, and we got a kind of a reunion, but let's see.
Maybe. I mean, we'll probably wrap this up now, because let's keep it to Postecoglou, and this is probably something for another time, but I do think another question out of all of this is how sacking Postecoglou off the back of winning a trophy, you know, how many managers are going to look at Spurs now with their history and be kind of put off it a little bit? We've already heard about Iriola potentially staying at Bournemouth, not being as interested. That wouldn't have been the case a few years ago. I wouldn't have thought so. Having said that, as you've often pointed out, it's definitely the case. Footballers are by their very nature, and managers as well, pretty egotistical in a good way. They believe they can go in and make an impact, and whatever's happened before, just as Ange did when after the Conte period. So I'm sure there'll be plenty out there who still back themselves. It's just whether they feel from what they hear from previous managers, what the conditions would be like. And whether that might impact people. But anyway, maybe one for another podcast about...
I agree with that. I'll just finish on it. I mean, I guess the one thing you'd say is that most clubs that are hiring managers have problems. You know, that tends to be the way. It's very unusual for, you know, the Liverpool on a slot situation. They come into this team that is, you know, already brilliant, has Mo Salah, and just keep going. That, you know, look at all the other jobs in the Premier League right now. You know, the big ones, Man United, Chelsea, if, you know, Newcastle, you know, they all have owners, big expectations, you know, fan bases with big expectations, lots of technocrats, you know, who all want to have a say in, you know, who gets signed and who doesn't get signed. They've all got PSR problems. You know, if you want to take the step up from, you know, one of the middle classes in the Premier League where it's slightly cozier to sort of one of the bigger clubs with bigger expectations, then unfortunately, I think it is usually an uncomfortable ride, you know, and you either sink in that or you swim in it, don't you? And I think, as you say, most of the managers back themselves to do it. But it's true. You know, I think everyone is aware of Spurs. They're aware of Daniel Levy. I think more than anything, they're aware of the budget. You know, I don't necessarily think it's a political thing or about the trophies or the Spursy thing. I think people in the industry are obviously very aware now that, you know, Tottenham don't pay the biggest wages. the transfer budget is not going to be huge. And ultimately, they're going to ask you always to overperform, you know, and they did that with Pochettino for a few years. And I think they always think they can pull that off over and over again. And ultimately, it's a really difficult trick to do. And it's going to be up to someone else now to try and make it happen.
Yeah, and this summer could be very interesting in terms of how much they have to spend, albeit they're now in the Champions League, so that may change things. But, you know, as you say, a difficult ride. It's one that Postecoglou certainly had and is now finished, sadly for him. But I think we both very much enjoyed the ride. It's been wild at times. Sad it's over. But I guess we'll look forward to what comes next, perhaps in the next podcast. But
it's a shame we don't get to hear from Dan, you know, after the hero and clown controversy. You know, this is Dan's final snub of Ange, isn't it? Not turning up for the yeah. final pod.
Oh, he bottled it. Absolutely bottled it. But yeah, that'd be interesting to hear what Dan's thoughts are. I think I know he's a big fan, even after that.
We should say that Dan and Ange have made up, haven't they? We should say, we won't say anything more than that. We'll leave it to Dan, but they have at least sort of restored some diplomatic relations since then. So even that ended.
Yeah.
That ended well.
I believe so.
Even if everything else didn't.
Absolutely. And I'll also say for all those out there who are Ange out and who is, you know, no matter what, who were probably hoping that Marcus Buckland would be on this podcast to give his take, given that he's definitely one of those. He is currently commentating on high level tennis at Roland Garros, so that's why he's not on this one right now. Quite a good excuse as it is, but I'm sure he'll be on soon, as will we. And that pretty much wraps it up. Thanks for listening.
Cheerio.